The content of this program is intended for a print and visually impaired audience. Hello, this is Fred Woodward from the Triangle Radio Reading Service. For the next hour, I'll be reading to you from The Week magazine, the best of the U.S. and international media each week. The Triangle Radio Reading Service wishes to thank Charlie and Carolyn Kerr for their support of today's reading of The Week magazine. This program honors Charlie's sister, Bonnie Cassidy, who continues to be a true inspiration to their family. We are reading this week from the October 3rd, 2014 issue of The Week magazine, the main stories and how they were covered. Obama takes the fight to ISIS in Syria. What happened? The U.S. and several Arab allies launched airstrikes against Sunni jihadists in Syria for the first time this week, killing scores of fighters with the Islamic State of Iraq and Syria and the separate al-Qaeda-linked group, Khorasan, in what President Obama and Pentagon officials said was the opening phase of a campaign lasting years. U.S. drones and fighter jets, including stealth F-22s, led warplanes from regional allies including Jordan, the United Arab Emirates, and Saudi Arabia in bombing ISIS training camps, arms depots, and command and control centers in the militant's capital of Raqqa and along the Iraq border. "You are seeing the beginnings of a sustained campaign," said Lieutenant General William Mayville, Director of Operations for the Joint Chiefs of Staff. Firing dozens of Tomahawk cruise missiles, U.S. warships in the Mediterranean launched a simultaneous attack on targets in northwestern Syria linked to the Khorasan group, which Mayville said was nearing the execution phase of an attack in Europe, or the U.S. intelligence officials said they believed the group, consisting of dozens of hardcore al-Qaeda veterans from Pakistan and Afghanistan, was plotting to blow up passenger planes using hard-to-detect bombs hidden in toothpaste tubes or with clothes dipped in explosives. "It must be clear," said Obama, "that we will not tolerate safe havens for terrorists who threaten our people." What the editorial said: Obama has overstepped his constitutional authority in launching a widening war in Syria, said the New York Times. The president claims to have good security reasons for unilaterally ordering a sustained military action against ISIS and Khorasan, but his assertions have not been tested or examined by the people's representatives in Congress. Given that there's been no public discussion of this war or a coherent plan for fighting it from the air, the strikes in Syria were a bad decision. "It's true that airstrikes alone won't defeat ISIS," said the Wall Street Journal. "The terrorists will now adapt by dispersing and perhaps blending into civilian areas. That's why destroying ISIS, Obama's stated goal, will require U.S. ground forces to gather intelligence and help coordinate the Iraqi army, the Kurdish Peshmerga, and Syrian rebels in the battle against ISIS fighters. The longer Obama refuses to approve such ground operations, the longer the mission of defeating ISIS will take." What the columnist said: Obama's airstrikes only approach may be more effective than people expect, said Fred Kaplan in Slate.com. The Syrian strikes are intended to help our allies on the ground by denying ISIS a secure rear, where it can store weapons and train fighters. A similar strategy worked during the 2007 Iraq War surge, when U.S. troops reduced violence in Baghdad by attacking areas around the city that insurgents used as gathering points and bomb-making factories. The president also deserves a lot of credit for persuading Arab nations to join this fight, said Jeffrey Goldberg in TheAtlantic.com. Like Obama, these nations' leaders have reluctantly concluded it would be insane for the civilized world to allow the barbarians of ISIS to overspread the Middle East. "The mission creep continues," said Daniel Larrison in the AmericanConservative.com. When airstrikes began in Iraq last month, The administration initially said that a sustained campaign is exactly what the U.S. was not starting. Yet just a few weeks later, we're told that the country is now at war in two Middle East nations and probably will be for years. What happened to the president who promised to pull America back from a perpetual war footing? He was mugged by reality, said Michael Hirsch in Politico.com. The swift, horrifying rise of ISIS, combined with polls showing that just 34% of Americans approve of his foreign policy, forced Obama to radically reevaluate his presidency. He realized he had no choice but to go from being the president who was elected to end wars, his most treasured self-image, to the president who finally leads one effectively. Obama is now a war president, and his legacy will heavily depend on whether he proves to be a good one. And a second main story this week, sounding the alarm on climate change. What happened? President Obama this week called on China to join the U.S. in leading a new worldwide effort to curb carbon dioxide emissions, warning that the window for successfully combating global warming was closing fast and that the biggest emitters needed to set an example to the rest of the world. Nobody gets a pass, the president told other world leaders at a UN climate change summit in New York City. We will do our part, and we'll help developing nations do theirs. The summit, which was attended by 120 heads of state, was an attempt to galvanize support for a comprehensive climate change agreement ahead of talks in Paris next year. But in a sign of how hard it will be to reach any sort of consensus on the issue, the leaders of many of the world's largest emitters, including China, India, and Russia, pointedly did not attend the meeting, sending deputies in their place. The summit came 2 days after UN Secretary General Ban Ki-moon joined an estimated 400,000 people on a march through Manhattan in the largest climate change rally in history. Smaller demonstrations took place in 166 other countries. The following day, the Rockefeller family announced that its $860 million philanthropic fund would be selling its investments in fossil fuels and reinvesting the money in clean energy. Valerie Rockefeller Wayne, a great-great-granddaughter of oil tycoon John Rockefeller, said there was a moral imperative to preserve a healthy planet. What the editorial said: is the world finally reaching a political tipping point about climate change? Asked the San Francisco Chronicle. We certainly don't have much time to spare. To prevent a global catastrophe, governments need to enact major carbon policy changes within 15 years, according to the Global Commission on the Economy and Climate. The evidence is all too clear, said the Miami Herald. Carbon dioxide levels are 42% higher than they were before the Industrial Revolution. This summer was the hottest on record for the planet, and 2014 is on course to be the warmest year ever. If governments fail to act, climatologists say, the consequences will be devastating. One not-so-minor problem, said the Wall Street Journal. The world's largest emitters are never going to sign agreements that impede economic progress. And without drastic action from powerhouses like China, which is responsible for a quarter of all global emissions, and India, where 25% of the population still lacks electricity, the West's exertions to save the planet will have only a negligible effect. All we'll do is stymie our own economic growth. What the columnist said: This just in, said Paul Krugman in the New York Times. Saving the planet would be cheap. It might even be free. Two recent studies, one by the International Monetary Fund, concluded that strict carbon legislation would in fact have very little negative effect on the economy and might actually lead to faster growth. This is partly because of the benefits of investing in renewable energy technology, and partly because the co-benefits of burning less coal, such as the improvements to public health, would result in huge savings. We do not need to succumb to climate despair. The alarmists keep insisting climate science is settled, said Stephen E. Koonin in the Wall Street Journal. It's not. Yes, global temperatures are changing, but we have no idea how much of that is caused by human activity. And the computer models that climatologists use to make long-term projections have proven to be crude and inaccurate. No one can satisfactorily explain why the rate of warming has slowed in the past 16 years, even though human contribution of CO2 levels has grown 25%. Doing nothing means taking a huge gamble on the world's future, said Eugene Robinson in the Washington Post. But even though chances for a landmark agreement between nations to cut emissions are still dim, the massive turnout for Sunday's marches showed that ordinary citizens are no longer willing to ignore the alarm bells. If governments are ever to tackle the climate change, we the people will have to show them the way. Controversy of the week. Ebola. Did the world wait too long to respond? Despite its terrifying reputation, Ebola has always been a rare exotic disease, reemerging every few years to kill a few dozen victims in remote African villages. But then came 2014, said Julia Belews in Vox.com. The unprecedented, nightmarish epidemic currently raging across West Africa has already killed at least 2,800, and health officials warn it may infect 20,000 people by November. If frantic efforts to slow the epidemic's spread do not succeed, according to a chilling projection released this week by the Federal Centers for Disease Control and Prevention, Ebola could infect as many as 1.4 million Africans by January. So far, the world and the U.S. have been slow in responding to the challenge, said the Washington Post in an editorial. President Obama last week ramped up the U.S. response to the outbreak, pledging $750 million, equipment, staff, and 3,000 troops to shore up the buckling health care systems in the worst affected countries, Guinea, Liberia, and Sierra Leone. Why did months pass before Obama took Ebola seriously? National security threats can come from viruses as well as terrorists. Let's face it, said Michael Spencer in NewYorker.com. The U.S. is acting out of fear, not compassion. Americans are worried Ebola is, as Obama put it, spiraling out of control and will spread to the U.S. But this epidemic began in March. And if the money Obama pledged last week had been invested into West Africa's health infrastructure much earlier, it would have prevented the worst effects of this epidemic and saved many lives. At this point, Ebola is a threat to the entire world, said Steve Brozak in BusinessWeek.com. About 70% of those infected are dying. All it takes is one sick passenger on a ship or an airplane for this to become a global crisis on a par with the plagues of history. There's no need to panic, said Mark Siegel in NationalReview.com. Chances of a global epidemic remain very small. Ebola was first identified back in 1976, and the virus has remained essentially stable since then, with no sign that it's mutating to become more easily transmissible. It is spread only by close contact with an infected person's bodily fluids. Meanwhile, trials of a promising vaccine against the disease are already underway at the National Institutes of Health. Even if a few cases do reach the U.S., said Dan Diamond in Forbes.com, the nation's hospitals would be well equipped to handle them. Ebola is spreading in Liberia and other West African countries because their health care systems are so fragile and their largely uneducated populations won't heed the warnings of health officials. The West must nonetheless respond with an urgent, all-out effort, said Laurie Garrett in ForeignPolicy.com. Ebola has the potential to undermine the great African economic miracle of the last decade if the outbreak isn't controlled and becomes endemic, frightening away foreign investment and draining resources. At that point, Africa could once again become a failed continent. It's both inhumane and foolish to think we need not be concerned about a tragedy unless it poses a threat to us, said Benjamin Hale in Slate.com. The fate of nations are more intertwined than ever. If we try to seek safety by shutting out the rest of the world, we are in for a brutally ugly awakening. Well, it was a good week for celebrity encounters. After former boxing champ Mike Tyson came to the aid of an injured motorcyclist on a Las Vegas freeway, stopping traffic and comforting the victim, Ryan Chesley, until paramedics arrived. It was the most reassuring thing in the world to have Mike Tyson telling people not to touch me, said Chesley. It was a good week for career change after Alaska TV newswoman Charlo Green announced she quit her job to dedicate all her energy to fighting for marijuana legalization in the state. As for this job, said Green in the middle of a 10 o'clock news, blanket, I quit. It was a good week for eternal devotion after archaeologists in Leicestershire, England, uncovered a pair of skeletons in a church graveyard that were still holding hands after nearly 700 years in the ground. It was a bad week for storming the castle after a Texas man who was fleeing police broke into a home where the homeowner stabbed him with a spear. I let him have it, said Jimmy Morgan Jr., a Game of Thrones enthusiast who collects medieval weaponry. It was a bad week for domestic pork after Virginia officials ordered a family to get rid of its 150-pound pet pig, Tucker. He is a pet, just like someone's dog, said Kim Johnson, noting that Tucker is house-trained and often plays with a neighbor's chihuahua. And it was a bad week for rough translations after an Indian newscaster was fired for referring to the visiting Chinese President Xi Jinping as 11 Jinping. Many viewers expressed support for the reporter, with one fan tweeting, "At least the anchor knows Roman numerals." On the briefing page, the battle over e-cigarettes. Is vaping a healthier alternative to smoking, or a lure to create more nicotine addicts? Are e-cigarettes dangerous? They're clearly less dangerous than cigarettes, but that doesn't mean they're safe. Electronic cigarettes are small, battery-powered devices that heat up a liquid containing nicotine and create an inhalable vapor instead of smoke. Like cigarettes, they provide a nicotine buzz, but they do not produce the tar, arsenic, benzene, vinyl chloride, and dozens of other carcinogens that result from burning tobacco. But critics contend that the health risks of vaping are still not known, especially because the liquid used to produce vapor contains various chemicals. Some brands contain diethyl glycol, which is also found in antifreeze. Nonetheless, e-cigarette sales are booming. About 6 million Americans use e-cigarettes, producing an estimated $2 billion a year in U.S. sales last year. Health advocates are warning that the devices are being marketed to minors with bubblegum flavor liquids and could hook a new generation on nicotine. We can't allow e-cigarettes to establish themselves the way cigarettes did, said Stanton Glantz, director of tobacco research at the University of California at San Francisco. Then try to stuff the genie back in the bottle once health risks come to light. What's at stake? Smoking has killed some 20 million Americans over the past 50 years. making it the leading preventable cause of death in the United States. More than 16 million citizens suffer from a smoking-related disease, costing $132 billion in direct health care expenses. Yet despite decades of warnings and widespread bans on smoking in public, 44 million Americans, one-sixth of the total population, continue to light up every day. Surveys show that nearly 70% of smokers say they want to quit, but fewer than 10% are able to do it without the aid of cessation treatments like nicotine patches. Among smokers who do manage to kick the habit, 3 out of 4 will pick it up again within a year. "We need better treatment," said Jed Rose, director of the Duke Center for Smoking Cessation. "The current ones just aren't working all that well." Do e-cigs help smokers quit? The issue is in dispute. E-cigarette makers, which include emerging startups like Enjoy and SmokeStick, as well as big tobacco mainstay Altria and Reynolds American, are legally banned from making any claim that their products help smokers quit. Studies have produced conflicting results. One British study this year found that smokers who turned to e-cigs were 60% more likely to succeed in quitting tobacco than those who used other nicotine replacements or went cold turkey. But a U.S. study found smokers using e-cigs were no more likely to succeed in quitting. It's clear, however, that the devices do not break a smoker's addiction to nicotine, and it is primarily that drug that compels people to keep smoking despite the obvious hazards. Critics say the perceived safety of vaping could lead more young people to take up e-cigs and get them addicted to nicotine. The very thing that could make them effective is also their greatest danger, says Tim McAfee in the Federal Centers for Disease Control and Prevention. Why aren't they regulated? Mainly because they're so new. E-cigarettes were created and sold in China in 2004. In 2009, about 2 years after e-cigarettes reached the U.S., the Food and Drug Administration tried to ban them as unapproved drug device combination products. But manufacturers filed suit, and the courts overturned the ban. This past April, the FDA reclassified e-cigarettes as tobacco products. The nicotine in them is derived from the plant and put forth a slew of proposed regulations, including restrictions on sales to minors and the addition of health warnings on packaging. But health advocates, including the American Heart Association, say those regulations don't go far enough and are calling for restrictions on advertising and marketing and the banning of candy-like flavors that critics say are clearly aimed at adolescents. "We are fiercely committed to preventing the tobacco industry from addicting another generation of smokers," said Heart Association CEO Nancy Brown. Are kids using e-cigarettes? Yes, and in growing numbers. The CDC recently reported that 260,000 middle and high school students had tried e-cigarettes in 2013, a threefold increase from just 2 years earlier. A separate study in the journal JAMA Pediatrics found that youth who tried e-cigarettes were 6 times more likely to take up smoking than those who didn't. Regardless of whether these teens eventually turn to traditional cigarettes, nicotine is highly toxic, and there is increasing evidence of its adverse effect on developing brains. The CDC says early exposure to nicotine can result in lasting deficits in cognitive function. But vaping advocates insist the overall benefits of getting smokers off tobacco far outweigh the risks. "In a couple of generations, we could have everybody off combustible cigarettes," said Cynthia Cabrera of the Smoke-Free Alternatives Trade Association. "But to do that, the industry has to survive. Overregulation," she said, "could completely obliterate this industry." Moving on to our columns. The first comes from David Brooks at the New York Times. "The Greatest Era in Human History." "Snap out of it," said David Brooks. "In recent months, the public has been gripped by a mood of pessimism and fatalism, with polls showing many Americans fear the country and the world are unraveling. While it's true that Washington's gridlock has created a worrisome leadership crisis, our sour despondency is unwarranted. This is an era of incredible progress and spreading affluence, with the nation's cities brimming with intellectual, artistic, and entrepreneurial energy. Tolerance for and acceptance of people who differ from ourselves is at an all-time high, as a stimulating stew of diverse cultures now adds new flavors to the American melting pot. We're living in an era with the greatest reduction in global poverty ever across Asia and Africa. And while we obviously still have problems, they are less dire than the civilization-threatening crises like World War I, the Great Depression, World War II, or the Cold War. Even compared with the 1970s, which brought us stagflation, Watergate, and rising crime, we are living in a golden age. So please stop the hand-wringing. The sky is not falling. In fact, it's mostly blue. From the United Kingdom, is devolution for England next? The unity of the United Kingdom isn't assured yet, said Andrew Rawnsley in The Observer. Scotland may have voted to stay in the UK last week by a comfy 55-45 result, but there is now a fierce after-battle between the parties and within them about the future governance of these islands. Frightened by polls on the eve of the referendum showing a slim lead for the pro-independence campaign, Prime Minister David Cameron promised the Scots greater autonomy if they stuck with the UK. Immediately after the vote, he pulled a switch, insisting Scottish reforms would have to be accompanied by legislation guaranteeing English votes for English laws. That would bar Scottish members of the Houses of Parliament from voting on legislation that affects only England. His motives were blatantly political. Labour is strong in Scotland, while Cameron's Conservatives dominate England. We could now see a descent into recriminatory and poisonous mess that leaves Scotland feeling betrayed and the rest of the UK aggrieved. It's patently unfair to have Scots vote on English law, but not vice versa, said Caroline Crampton in The New Statesman. Recently, for example, Scottish MPs were instrumental in passing a law that dramatically raised university tuition in England. Meanwhile, the Scottish Parliament, which already has policy-making powers over areas like health and education, scrapped tuition fees altogether in Scotland. But fixing the disparity would be fiendishly complicated, since who decides what matters are purely English and what are national? Calm down, said Ian Martin in the Daily Telegraph. English-only votes can work just fine with a spot of good old-fashioned British constitutional improvisation. A nonpartisan commission could decide which legislation gets separate votes, and if a bill affects England but has financial implications for Scotland, the body could apply a pre-agreed formula for funding. Of course, Labour opposes the idea because it fears it could find itself in power at a UK level but not have the votes to drive through bills on exclusively English matters. That's too bad. If the party wants to govern England, it must win English votes. Such a model would be doomed, said Dominic Lawson in The Times. It would effectively create an English parliament within the UK parliament, which would have to be led by an English first minister who would rival Britain's prime minister. A similar scenario played out during the last days of the USSR, when Boris Yeltsin became the first president of Russia and immediately butted heads with Soviet leader Mikhail Gorbachev, resulting in the Soviet Union's breakup. England, with 85% of the population, is even more disproportionately significant to the UK than Russia was to the USSR. Far from saving the Union, devolving more powers to England would only divide it further. And this from Australia. ISIS threatens terror at home. ISIS is out to kill any Australian it can find, said Tory Shepherd in the Advertiser. In a dramatic escalation of the terrorist group's threats against our citizens, a leader with the Islamic State of Iraq and Syria has issued a fatwa calling on Muslims everywhere to murder Western infidels. The command came just days after the largest counterterrorism raid in Australian history, when authorities arrested 15 people in Sydney in connection with an ISIS plot to kidnap and behead random Australians and post videos of the executions online. Intercepted jihadist chatter also suggests an attack on Parliament House might be in the works. The government is spooked, said Stephen Scott in the Courier Mail. Prime Minister Tony Abbott has proposed tough anti-terrorism laws that would give security agencies greater leeway in detaining and surveilling terrorist suspects and would allow the government to ban Australians from traveling to certain foreign destinations. There may be more restrictions to come, Abbott said, so that there can be more protection for others. He insisted, though, that the new laws were not aimed at Muslims. Oh, really? Asked Daniel Piotrowski in the dailymail.co.uk. Tell that to the Australian sheikh who just missed his flight to Mecca for the Hajj because he was questioned at Sydney's airport. Sheikh Shadi Al Suleiman, a senior member of the Australian National Imams Council, met with the Prime Minister just last month as part of a delegation of imams advising the government on changes to the terror laws. Yet apparently he was deemed suspicious enough to warrant extra scrutiny before leaving the country. Muslim leaders say this incident is just another sign of a worrying rise in anti-Islamic sentiment across the country. The Muslim community is split, said Paul Kelly in The Australian. As Abbott explained, ISIS sympathizers make up a tiny minority of Australian Muslims. Yet we can't ignore the fact that there are some 70 Australians fighting in Syria and Iraq and scores more would-be jihadists here at home. Mohammed Ali Bariali, the top Australian in ISIS and the alleged mastermind of the Sydney beheading plot, was an Afghan refugee who lived here for years. He has radicalized others and continues to do so from Syria. The more success the Islamic State enjoys in the Middle East, the more trouble for Australia's domestic security. That's why Australia is joining the fight against ISIS in the Middle East, said the Herald Sun in an editorial. Airstrikes by the U.S.-led coalition this week struck Raqqa, the Syrian town where Bariali was last seen. Australian fighter jets are on standby to help. ISIS is on notice. The civilized world will no longer stand by and allow its reign of terror to continue unchecked. And we'll move right into the last word article. Eating barbecue for a living. Being the country's first barbecue editor is a joy, said Daniel Vaughan, if you don't mind the heartburn. I thought you'd be fatter. It's a common outburst when people first meet me at a barbecue event, book signing, or one of the 100-plus barbecue joints I visit in a year traveling across Texas and beyond. How are you not? A pause to size me up. 400 pounds. This line of inquiry appears to be an unavoidable hazard of the job. Since Texas Monthly named me the nation's first and only full-time barbecue editor in March 2013, my health has been a topic of international discussion. When the New York Times reported on the news of my hiring, it asked Jake Silverstein, Texas Monthly's then editor-in-chief, about plans for my fitness program. A few months later, a live spot with an Australian morning show ended with the female's host exclaiming, "Oh, your poor colon." They went to commercial before I could thank her for her consideration. Weird as it is to say, I understand the morbid fascination. My job requires that I travel from one end of the state to the other eating smoked brisket, pork ribs, sausage, and beef ribs. Of course, my diet is going to raise eyebrows, including those of my doctor. During one of my semi-annual visits to see him, when my blood work showed an elevated cholesterol level, He gave me a script for statins and a helpful catalog of high cholesterol foods to avoid. First on the list, beef brisket. Second, pork ribs. When I told him about my job, he just said, "Maybe you could eat a little less brisket." I promised to focus more on smoked chicken, but the pledge wasn't as empty as the calories in my next order of banana pudding. All jokes aside, I do understand the long-term perils of my new profession. I've taken those statins religiously for several years, and I'm doing my part to keep the antacid companies in business. My wife, to her credit, has been supportive of my decision to change careers, albeit a bit less enthusiastic than she was when I was made an associate at the Dallas architecture firm I worked with for 6 years. But to anyone who asks if I'm worried about an early grave, I just say I'm pre-humously donated my body to barbecue. My interest in barbecue started casually enough 13 years ago when I moved to Texas from Ohio with irregular though much savored dinners at local barbecue joints. But the fixation began in earnest in 2006. Using Texas Monthly's 2003 list of the top 50 barbecue joints as a guide, my friend Sam Watkins and I set out on a Central Texas and Hill Country adventure, stopping at 16 barbecue places in 3 days. On Saturday morning, August 19, 2006, a bite of peppery smoked brisket at Louis Mueller Mueller Barbecue in Taylor changed my life. From that point forward, barbecue was a personal obsession. It took almost 2 years before I started to write seriously about the cuisine. Inspired by Tex Smith, the founder of one of the first websites dedicated to reviewing barbecue joints, I launched my own review blog, Full Custom. On July 31, 2008, I wrote my first post, a single paragraph on Rick's Smokehouse Barbecue in Garland. I've since learned that carcinogenic isn't a positive adjective for describing flavor. The prose was pretty awful, but the timing was impeccable. The zeitgeist of Texas barbecue was in its infancy but growing fast. Barbecue hounds treasured their grease-stained copies of the Texas Monthly Top 50 lists from 1997, 2003, and 2008. Then the landscape of barbecue in Texas, or really in this country, changed forever. On December 2, 2009, Aaron and Stacy Franklin opened their trailer at Interstate 35 and Concordia Avenue in Austin. On a drizzly afternoon a month later, I met two fellow barbecue bloggers for our first slice of fatty brisket from Franklin Barbecue. It was barbecue nirvana, equaled only by the fare that day back at Louis Mueller. Since then, the restaurant has become the most well-known barbecue joint in the country. Emboldened by brisket, I sent an unsolicited email a few days later to Texas Monthly's food editor, Patricia Sharp, pleading for a spot on the tasting team for the next barbecue issue, to be published in 2013. After a few meetings and a bit of cajoling, my dream was more than fulfilled. I signed a contract with Texas Monthly that not only landed me a spot on the tasting team, but eventually led to my job as a full-time barbecue editor. I read an interview recently with Osaki San, Tokyo's most well-respected ramen critic, who described his ramen eating habits. There are two types of ramen junkies, the repeater and the collector. I'm a collector. I try to eat as many different bowls as I can. That's me too. Trying a new joint that turns out to be mediocre is more rewarding than having another meal at one of Texas's best. If all I wanted was to eat Q for pleasure, I'd stop in at Dallas's Pecan Lodge just a few miles from my house. But I'd rather save the stomach space for finding the next hidden gem. When I plan a trip, I map it out so I can visit as many restaurants, trailers, and food stands as I can feasibly cram into a day. That strategy causes things to quickly balloon, as they did 1 week this past July when I hit 23 places. That's excessive, even by my standards, but it was Texas barbecue week. Here are my notes on what occurred over just 2 days, over just two of those days. July 15, 2014, 7:30 a.m. Wake up to get my son and daughter ready for the day. I'm a little groggy because I turned in my weekly column to my editor at 1:20 a.m. 8:30 a.m. Drop the kids off at daycare and head south on I-35. 11:30 a.m. Arrive in Austin. First stop, Micklewaite Craft Meats, where I order beef cheek tacos, a few slices of house-made kielbasa, and one slice of too-tempting-to-ignore brisket I spy on the blocks. They also give me a new lemon bar dessert they just started serving. I can't possibly eat all three tacos, so I give one to the trio ogling my plate at an adjacent table. The other I wrap up for my editor, Andrea, whom I'm meeting for a second lunch. 12:15 p.m. Pick up Andrea and drive over to Lambert's as part of my research for a midterm report card on the 2013 Top 50 list. I order us two combo plates as well as the fried pie and the banana pudding, two desserts endemic to barbecue menus, an aspect of the culture that I plan to write about in the next few months. I debate adding the boar ribs, but they're not smoked. Second lunch is over. 1:30 p.m. Return my very full editor, she made the rookie mistake of eating too much, to the office and head out to Schmidt Family Barbecue in Bee Cave for a meal I'll later review on tmbbq.com. The brisket is good, so I eat it all. That'll cost me later. 2:30 p.m. Before going back to the Texas Monthly office, I stop in at Terry Black's Barbecue to bring a little cue back to my colleagues. Being the brisket fairy is a perk of the job. 4:30 p.m. Go to a local pub called The Crown and Anchor to film a segment with Aaron Franklin for his new barbecue show on PBS. It's happy hour, so we drink a beer and talk about the history of brisket. 5:55 p.m. Arrive at Texas Monthly dinner event at Franklin Barbecue. It's a full house. It's the best barbecue in the world, but I'm already full, so I keep it to a few bites of beef rib, brisket, and prime rib. 10:15 p.m. Drive to Lockhart and check into the Best Western, a motel I've stayed at many times. Prep for an interview scheduled for the next day with Nina Sells, the owner of Smitty's Market. 2:15 a.m. Transcribe and upload an interview with the owners of Hutchins Barbecue in McKinney to tmbbq.com. Turn in. 4 a.m. Wake up with terrible heartburn. Chew on a Gaviscon, drink some water, and go back to bed. July 16, 2014. 9 a.m. Arrive at Smitty's and meet with Nina. There's no coffee, so I caffeinate with an RC Cola while we do the interview. 10:30 a.m. They have a combo plate on the menu at Smitty's, a barbecue week special, so I order a brisket rib and sausage plate. Add an order of the rare, just the way I like it, prime rib. 11 a.m. Arrive at Cruz Market just up the road and order the same meal I've just eaten at Smitty's, which I'll review as part of my midterm roundup. Noon. Mad Jack's Barbecue Shack is the newest barbecue joint in Lockhart. Stop in for a meal on my way out of town. 1 p.m. Pull into Zimmer Hansel's Barbecue in Smithville as part of my goal to interview every pitmaster featured in the top 50. Bert Bunty isn't much of a talker, so after 15 minutes, I wrap it up and order a sampling of meats to go. 2:15 p.m. Interview the Prowse family, who own a 110-plus-year-old meat market and barbecue joint in LaGrange. I'm almost thankful they're sold out of barbecue. 5 p.m. Stop at Highway 77 Cafe in Rosebud for two pieces of chocolate cake to go, a peace offering to the family, as I'll be late to dinner. 7:15 p.m. After 565 miles and 9 barbecue joints in 2 days, arrive home, bathe the kids, put them to bed, and pack their lunches. 10 p.m. Sit down to write a weekly barbecue news roundup for the site. 1:30 a.m. Complete my post and go to bed. People romanticize the notion of being a food critic, but the challenges of covering a state as vast as Texas and a cuisine as niche as barbecue are something I wasn't really aware of until I entered this world. Overnight trips keep me away from my wife and kids. Spending the morning and afternoon driving and eating means keeping late hours so I can meet daily deadlines. Mainlining coffee to jumpstart my day only adds to the dehydration brought on by consuming vast quantities of salty meat. After a couple of carnivorous days, painful white bumps form on my tongue. I crave broccoli, not salad, always broccoli when I get back home. But my cholesterol has never been above 200 since I've been the barbecue editor. As for my weight, that battle is harder to win. It hovers around 10 pounds heavier than when I started the job. I've always been a big guy, but that's the difference between an XL and a double XL. Despite the small blow to my vanity, it's hard to argue with the thousands who have told me that I have their dream job. I know I'm a lucky guy, and I don't take it for granted, which is why being health conscious is something I strive to do. Believe me, I'll go to the grave, hopefully much later than sooner, knowing that I do, in fact, have the greatest job in the world. This was excerpted from an article in the September 2014 issue of Texas Monthly. Back on the health and science page, treat cats like cats. Cats aren't dogs. That may sound obvious, but it's something a lot of pet owners tend to forget, and it's stressing cats out. While dogs tend to be sociable animals that are happy to be petted and hang out with other dogs, cats are the opposite. They generally don't enjoy fellow feline company, and they hate sharing space. Researchers in Britain installed infrared cameras in homes to observe cats' nocturnal activities. While the owners were under the impression that their pets got on well, the videos showed the reality. Cats angrily hissing at each other and fighting for the warmest spot on the bed. John Bradshaw, director of anthrozoology at the University of Bristol in England, said two common feline conditions, dermatitis and cystitis, have a strong psychological component and are often induced by stress. Unlike dogs, Bradshaw tells The Telegraph, the cat is still halfway between a domestic and a wild animal, and it's not enjoying 21st century living. A simple way to prolong life. To delay aging, spend more time standing up. That's the surprise conclusion of a new study by Swedish scientists, reports the Daily Telegraph. Researchers at Karolinska University Hospital in Stockholm took blood samples from a group of sedentary, overweight men and women, all 68 years old, and measured the length of their telomeres, caps on the end of DNA that generally shorten and fray with age. Half of the volunteers were started on a moderate exercise program and told to sit less, while the other half were told to continue their normal lives. When the scientists took a second blood test 6 months later, they found that the telomeres in the normal group had shortened, as expected, but those in the exercise group had actually grown longer. Their cells had become physiologically younger. Even more surprising, this wasn't because of the exercise regime. The telomeres of the volunteers who worked out the most tended to grow less and sometimes even shortened. The most beneficial factor was time spent standing up. The less time people spent sitting down, the more their telomeres grew. Formal exercise may be increasing, but at the same time, people spend more time sitting, said co-author Mylis Helenis. Sitting and sedentary behavior may be an important and new health hazard of our time. And the health scare of the week, beware of artificial sweeteners. Artificial sweeteners, among the most common food additives in the world may be contributing to obesity rather than preventing it, reports the Financial Times. In a series of experiments, Israeli scientists found that exposure to three sweeteners widely used in low-calorie snacks and beverages, saccharin, sucralose, and aspartame, raised blood sugar levels in mice and increased the risk of glucose intolerance, a condition that often leads to obesity and diabetes. When the researchers at the Weizmann Institute of Science then gave a regular dose of saccharin to seven human volunteers who did not typically use sweeteners, four of them developed glucose intolerance. Previous studies have suggested that certain artificial supplements can give consumers a sweet tooth, making them more likely to seek out sugary foods. But this research suggests that sweeteners might actually alter the body's metabolism to make weight gain more likely. Sweeteners, the report found, may have directly contributed to enhancing the exact epidemic that they themselves were intended to fight. On the Talking Points page now, Chris Christie, back in the 16 race. The giant inflatable Chris Christie for president trial balloon is up in the skies again, said Will Bunch in the Philadelphia Daily News. 9 months after federal prosecutors began investigating the Bridgegate scandal, a New York City TV station reported last week that the feds haven't uncovered any evidence that the New Jersey governor knew what his aides were up to. Prosecutors followed up that report by announcing that the investigation is ongoing, and while 9 months is an eternity in today's politics, it may take much longer than that to determine whether Christie was involved in the politically motivated lane closures on the George Washington Bridge. Nevertheless, conservatives are already rubbing their hands with glee, and Christie 16 is back with a vengeance. Bridgegate doesn't seem to have caused serious damage to Christie's presidential prospects, said Jennifer Rubin in the Washington Post. No frontrunner has emerged during his time in purgatory, and the governor remains near the top of the polls on the 2016 race. He already has the common touch and a radiant personality. Now all he needs is a campaign agenda. The simple reality is that the GOP needs Christie, or someone like him, said Michael Gerson in the Washington Post. After the GOP's defeat in 2012, the party leadership acknowledged that to win the national elections, it needed to appeal to middle-class voters. In 2016, Republicans must nominate a candidate who can reach across the base, and Christie, a man with serious blue-collar appeal, fills the bill. Christie is still a very long shot to win the nomination, said Jonathan Tobin in CommentaryMagazine.com. Even if he wasn't directly involved in Bridgegate, the scandal forever altered his image. The authentic, gutsy politician who took no guff was transformed into a bully who brooked no opposition. Besides, Christie remains under investigation by multiple entities in multiple states over multiple alleged wrongdoings, said Olivia Nuzzi in the DailyBeast.com. New York officials are looking into whether the governor illegally diverted $1.8 billion in federal funds appropriated for a tunnel to pay for other projects. Federal prosecutors are also examining whether Christie's administration threatened to hold back Hurricane Sandy recovery money from Hoboken's mayor unless she pushed through a real estate deal. The dark clouds of scandal will linger into 2015, far too late for Christie to launch a credible campaign. Rape. Is the epidemic real? If anyone doubts that sexual assault is a serious, ubiquitous problem in our culture, said Callie Boisman in Jezebel.com, consider a new report from the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention. The CDC's survey reveals that nearly one in five U.S. women, 19.3%, has been raped at some point in her life. Perhaps that horrific number will finally silence conservatives who are obsessed with trying to prove that the rape culture is made up. Sorry, but the CDC report won't end that debate, said Claire Grodin in NewRepublic.com. For years, the Department of Justice's National Crime Victimization Survey has been the gold standard for rape statistics. But it estimated only 243,800 rape cases in 2011. The CDC's findings indicate 2 million women are raped every year. Why the massive disparity between these numbers? The CDC used a very broad definition of rape in its survey of women, including sexual encounters in which respondents say they felt unsafe or were drunk or high and thus unable to consent. Clearly, the rape epidemic is fiction, said Kevin D. Williamson in NationalReview.com. Most scholarly studies indicate that the real victimization rates are 0.16% to 2.16%, not even remotely close to 19.3%. As for the supposed prevalence of rape on college campuses, the Department of Justice study notes that half of the students who later define a sexual experience as a sexual assault admit that they did not think the incident was serious enough to report. Not incidentally, federal crime statistics show that the incident of sexual assault has declined 64% since 1995. For these reasons, the CDC statistics are meaningless and dangerous, said Kathy Young in Slate.com. By blurring the lines between true sexual assault and the gray areas that result from mixed signals, alcohol-addled memories, and misunderstandings, we only increase the likelihood of false accusations. Crime statistics and studies indicate that from 8 to 10% of reported rapes are unfounded, while up to half the incidents may not meet the legal definition of a crime. That leaves us with a lot of unsatisfying uncertainty, said Megan McArdle in BloombergView.com. Rape is inherently a hard crime to prosecute, often having just two witnesses, each telling a different story. How widespread is this terrible crime? How common are false accusations? What we know is that we don't know. Well, we've run out of time for today's episode of the week. Be sure to listen again next time. We hope you've enjoyed it. I'm Fred Woodward. The Triangle Radio Reading Service wishes to thank Charlie and Carolyn Kerr for their support of today's Reading of the Week magazine. This program honors Charlie's sister, Bonnie Cassidy, who continues to be a true inspiration to their family. The content of this program is intended for a print and visually impaired audience. The broadcast is available as a podcast right after the broadcast at our website, TriangleReadingService.org. So long until next time.